It's good to see everybody. I guess they gave us a little bit of a new arrangement here that we'll have to get used to. I'm a little bit disoriented with it, so if I wander up where the aisle used to be and bump into a few of you, I'll ask for your indulgence there. But we'll see if we can make it work. They kind of shunt me around every once in a while, so we're pretty used to it. We're going to continue our study of Genesis. Last week we got up through chapter 20. And we're going to go through some highlights of the next few chapters today. We'll be reading some excerpts from chapters 21 through 24, covering really several stages of Abraham's life, but kind of a theme tying together Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, the conclusion in a lot of ways of one generation, of Abraham's generation, and the setting of the stage for the future with Isaac, and later on we'll meet Rebecca. So kind of a transition point in Abraham's life. We're going to go back through briefly, just remind you some of the highlights of the last few chapters, because Abraham is given to us as one of our prime examples of living by faith. And so it's a good idea, as best as time permits, to try to put together a lot of the different things that we can learn from him. Clyde's going to go ahead and lead us in a short time of prayer, and then we'll get started on some Genesis.
Dear God in heaven, we come to you today with thanksgiving in our hearts, thanking you for all the blessings that you have given us from the beginning of time until now. We do thank you for our teacher who has boldly instructed us about faith, even the faith of our fathers. We pray that we would apply these kinds of things that we are learning about into our lives, that we will become more faithful and trusting into Jesus Christ our Lord, who is our great leader. Be with us now and forever. It is our prayer in Christ's name. Amen.
All right, thanks very much. We've been studying Abraham, or as he used to be known, Abram, for several weeks now. And the first time we meet Abram is back in chapter 14, when Abram is called to leave home. And God makes very clear to him, leave your home, leave your family, leave your people. And this same call is really given to us, except not in a literal way. We're not expected to leave the earth physically, or to leave human society physically, or to go someplace else in the world. We are, however, expected in our hearts to leave behind the things of the world, including the loyalties of the world, the things that you're taught by the world. The world has its own so-called faith. They don't call it that, but the world has its own beliefs and principles and values that they consider to be, in their own way, sacred. And to follow God, we have to be willing to leave those behind. Even if they're things that we feel very strongly about, we have to be ready to set it all down and trust God from now on. Follow Jesus. Jesus says to his followers, come follow me. And if you're in a boat fishing with your dad, he says, come follow me. If you're sitting in a tax collector's booth, he says, come follow me. If you're an American, he says, come follow me. Don't follow America anymore. If you're a Russian, he says, come follow me. Don't follow Russia anymore. Difficult call for everybody. The gospel is equally challenging for everybody. The gospel does not accommodate any human culture or philosophy or even a human theology. The gospel is its own truth. And Abraham made that great step of faith, going where God told him to go, going someplace he'd never gone before, going someplace where the things he'd heard about Canaan, most of them were bad. But he got up and went anyway, because God wanted to put him in a place where his faith would shine. God didn't want him in a place where his bank account would be maximized. He didn't want him to be in a place where his pleasure would be maximized. He wanted him in a place where his faith would be maximized.
Or serving false gods.
Serving false gods is a very appropriate phrase, because everybody serves false gods. Even atheists serve false gods. They just don't call them gods. And even Christians worship a lot of false gods. They just don't call it worship. You know, worship is not when you sit down and say, I'm going to worship now. Worship is whatever you do that shows your deep loyalty, your deep respect, your deep admiration, and those things properly belong to God alone. God's covenant with Abraham included a lot of things. God promised that Abraham would have a great name, promised that he would make him a great nation, promised him a lot of things.
Be father of many nations.
Be the father of many nations, which in fact is what his name Abraham means. So Abraham was blessed. But Abraham was also a blessing. One of the things that Abraham was told from the very beginning is that God was not just giving him a lot of great stuff just so Abraham could go around and show all his friends that God thought he was a real cool guy. Abraham was entrusted with things because to God, blessing is always balanced with one of our favorite words that starts with an R. Responsibility. Responsibility is inherent in knowing God. We saw that all the way back in Genesis. Even before there was sin in the world, Adam had responsibility. Take care of that garden that I made. Take care of that world that I made for you. We can't ever expect to get out of responsibility as long as we're in this earth. It's an inherent part of belonging to God. It's not a punishment. It's not an injustice. It's an inherent part of belonging to God. And Abraham accepted that. Now, last week, we saw a lot of interactions between Abraham, and Abraham was holy. Now, that doesn't mean he was morally superior. Too often we misuse the word holy as if it means morally superior. Holy just means
set apart for God.
You belong to God. That's what it means. God said, Abraham, I would like you to belong to me. And what did Abraham say?
Okay,
no problem. And Abraham and his family were holy. Now, they were not in any sense of the word ethically perfect. And they were really not even ethically superior to anybody else. It's a different distinction. Holiness doesn't mean a moral judgment, moral superiority. Holiness just means an acceptance that you belong to God. We see that a lot in the Old Testament in the book of Leviticus. And I know that you all spend a lot of your spare time browsing through Leviticus and reading about things. So you probably already know this, but there are a lot of normal, everyday objects that were sanctified to be holy so that they could be used in the temple service. The spoons and tables and other implements were not any different from other spoons and tables and implements, except that they belonged to God now, and you couldn't mess with them anymore. Same with you and me. You are holy. If you responded to Jesus' call, Jesus was asking you, would you like to be holy? Would you like to belong to me? Would you like to confess me as your Lord and Savior? And if you said yes and were baptized into Christ, you're holy. It doesn't mean that you automatically changed to some perfect person. It just means you accepted that you belong to God. And you accepted this balance then of blessing and responsibility. Well, see, we often see in Abraham's life this balance between blessing and responsibility. And the holy is often contrasted with the unclean. Cleanness and holiness are important concepts in the Old Testament, even before the book of Leviticus kind of made them more formalized. Well, chapter 18, Abraham gets some visitors. These three angels come to see him. And they have two jobs, two very different things. What were the angels supposed to do first?
Visit Abraham.
They visited Abraham. And they were there to give, they weren't just there to give him some new recipes or something. They came to tell him something specific.
We're going to have a son.
That's right. All these years, you know, how long have we been waiting? You know, we've been waiting several weeks since we studied chapter 12, and we're told Abraham was going to be a great nation with descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and we keep waiting for it to happen. Well, Abraham didn't have to wait 4 or 5 weeks. He had to wait 25 years. And so finally God says, okay, just a little bit longer. It says, matter of fact, he says, this time next year. And it's just another reminder of how God's promises are certain. But the reason why we so often doubt or question God's promises is because we're more concerned with their timing than with their certainty. So Abraham learned to be content with the certainty of God's promises, not the timing, not the worry about it. He had to wait a long time to have that son that God had promised him. Well, now they come and tell him one more year. Well, he'd been waiting 24, so one more year, he can probably manage that. And that's in fact what he does. Well, these angels also have a different mission. After they tell Abraham that at this time next year Sarah's going to have a son, what else are they supposed to do?
Rescue Lot.
They end up rescuing Lot. Now, in fact, they were told that that was kind of a contingency plan because they were supposed to go where?
Sodom
and Gomorrah. They were supposed to find out whether or not this uncleanness in Sodom and Gomorrah had reached the point where God needed to take action. And it's not because Sodom and Gomorrah were worse than everybody else, because if you read ancient history, an awful lot of places were just as bad. Mm-hmm. It's that Sodom and Gomorrah were where Abraham and his holy family lived. And God's presence cannot exist when there is too much uncleanness. It's not an arbitrary decision. It's not an arbitrary policy on God's part. I just don't want to get my robe dirty. It's a part of his nature. He cannot have fellowship with darkness. He cannot have fellowship with it. We have to be cleansed to even be in his presence. The high priest in the old days of the Levitical law, to go into the most holy place to offer the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement, he couldn't even see that ark. He had to carry this thick cloud of incense right in front of his face, because if he'd have seen it as a man of unclean lips, he would have been immediately annihilated. And so Sodom and Gomorrah are being dealt with because of the uncleanness, but it's because there's holiness too close to it. God wants to maintain his presence in Abraham's life. So God kind of has this rhetorical question. When the angels are getting ready to leave, he even says, and it's just a rhetorical question, he says, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Because it's going to shock him. Abraham's a nice guy. He's going to be upset to find out that all these people are going to be destroyed. He might even be worried about his nephew Lot in there. Well, that's just a rhetorical question, because certainly God goes on to say to himself, well, I made the covenant with Abraham. Abraham is my chosen family. He's holy. So of course I'm going to tell him what I'm going to do. And this is a truth about God that is also appropriate for our lives, because see, God, unlike everybody else, God tells us the truth. God doesn't figure out what we want to hear and then tell us it. God tells us the truth. Sometimes the truth is exhilarating. It sets you free. Sometimes the truth is terrifying. There are things about God that are terrifying, and he doesn't hide them from us. God does not hide the truth. God does not hide the fact that Sodom and Gomorrah, what happened to them with that burning sulfur, is just a very tiny fraction of God's power being unleashed on the unclean. And the time will come when God will not restrain it anymore. That is a truth that a lot of so-called believers don't want to accept, because they judge God by worldly standards instead of letting God judge the world by his standards. And it's a characteristic of God. The Bible is full of things that confuse us, that challenge us, that frighten us, just as it's full of things that it encourage us and comfort us. And we have to accept God the way he is, because the truth is the truth, whether we like it or not emotionally. Sometimes you like it emotionally, sometimes you won't like it emotionally. You have to accept it because it's true, not because it's exciting, or not because it's what you wanted to hear, or not because it gives you an inside information on whether the Buckeyes are going to beat Michigan next year. It has to be because it's true. And this is what God is all about. After this, then, there comes this fearful cleansing. And as Warren pointed out, these angels go to Sodom and Gomorrah, and they find out that these characters are everybody, every bit as unclean as they've been cracked up to be. The angels get a very rude reception in Sodom, and they end up rescuing Lot's family. It turns from a reconnaissance mission to a rescue mission. Lot's family is given the choice. And as it turns out, only Lot, his wife, and his two daughters believe the message from these angels that go there. And the rest of the city is destroyed. The uncleanness is washed away. Even Lot's wife does not obey the angels' instructions. And yet, in pointing that out, we should also remember, Lot was originally told, okay, city's going to get it. You need to run off to those mountains over there and hide up there. You remember what Lot said? I don't think I can make it that far. Can I stop at that nice little town there? God being God said, okay, no problem. Because see, Lot was a real goof. You know, we've seen him do some just ridiculously sinful things, and yet he was holy. He was part of Abraham's family. He was holy. He was a goof, but he was holy, which is very comforting to me, because I don't have the choice to be a goof or not to be a goof. I only have the choice to be a holy goof or an unholy goof. And this is what Lot illustrates. Because the angel said, okay, you asked. You didn't just say, well, God just needs to understand if I stop there. He said, can I please have it there? And so God gives him what we commonly call grace, what we commonly call mercy, and lets him go to a little town there. Well, you turn around from that, and you see another reason why holiness is not being morally superior and perfect and flawless. Because we see at the end of chapter 19 and in chapter 20, we see Lot and Abraham both goofing up. You see, after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his two daughters are off by themselves, and his two daughters ask themselves, what would Aunt Sarah do? And out of that comes these two guys, Moab and Ben-Ami. And they give rise to two nations, the Moabites and the Ammonites, who for many years were a thorn in the side of the Israelites. They led them into sin, they attacked them, and so naturally, God wiped these guys out at first convenience, right?
No,
because you read in Deuteronomy 2, when Joshua was leading the people in the Promised Land and he told them to get rid of the Canaanites, he said, now the Moabites, when you come to their border, you stop, because I gave them their land, even though they're going to tempt you to sin and do all kind of things, because they came from Abraham's family, and he couldn't help blessing them, even though there was a lack of appreciation and a lack of obedience on their part. And Abraham himself repeats the past with his interlude with Abimelech and lying about who Sarah is, tells Abimelech he's his sister because he's afraid, and who gets punished for it? Abimelech, of course. You know, Abraham and Sarah going around lying all the time, and of course Abimelech gets punished. Well, see, there is an example of how blessing is balanced with responsibility, because when someone holy strays from the truth, when someone holy messes up, who does that holy person put at risk? The people around them, the unclean. Because the unclean, to come into contact with the holy, they're the ones at risk. And it's something to remember, because it's so ironic. Abimelech has to pay Abraham all this money for taking advantage of Sarah, and then Abimelech has to ask Abraham to pray for him. And it's something that we should take very seriously as an illustrative example, because it reminds us of the importance of us as holy people. And you are holy, regardless of how many things you goof up. You're holy. You're just as holy as anybody else here. You're no more holy and you're no less holy. You belong to God. You told God you wanted to belong to Him, and that involves a lot of blessings and a lot of responsibilities. And it's something to keep in mind when you run into daily life, the people around you, it's a responsibility, the holiness that you carry around. Well, now that leads us up to chapter 21, where we're going to read now about Isaac being born, and we're going to read about the way that this changes things. Isaac is the fulfillment of a lot of great promises. Abraham's been waiting for years. But it also means, when Isaac is born, it means that time has come to move things along. And what we're going to see over these chapters is a lot of changes come up, because one of the, again, another inherent truth about this world is that it always changes. It always passes from one generation to the next. Everyone who's here today, none of us are going to be here 100 years from now. It's going to be a different bunch of people sitting in this room. And there's going to be different people out there worrying about the problems that we worry about today. And Abraham knew that. And the birth of Isaac is a great thing for Abraham and Sarah, but it also means this is the new generation. You're going to have to become lesser, and he's going to become greater. And it's an inherent truth about the world. Let's do a little reading here. If we get some people ready with everything queued up here. Brenda, have you got that there? Genesis 21. Could you go from verse 1 to 7? And then, Frank, could you go from verse 8 to 21? We'll just read that part right now.
Mm-hmm. Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the very time God had promised him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham sacrificed him as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age.
The child grew and was weaned, and on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. As Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar, the Egyptian, had born to Abraham was mocking, and she said to Abraham, get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. The matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son. But God said to him, do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant. Listen to what Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation, also because he is your offspring. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes, and then she went off and sat down nearby, about a bowshot away, for she thought, I cannot watch the boy die. As she sat there nearby, she began to sob. God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift up the boy and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went, filled the skin with water, and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert, became an archer. And while he was living in the desert of Haran, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. That gives us plenty to talk about for a little bit here. This represents the past, the present, and the future. Abraham's past comes back again because you remember back a few chapters ago when Abraham had first got those promises of having a son who would grow into a great nation, he and Sarah got a little bit antsy, and the result of it was Ishmael being born to Sarah's maidservant. And ever since then, there's been one consequence of that after another. There's also the present. Abraham and Sarah finally get to have their child. And then there's also the future, the posterity of these two children and the ways that that is going to have both spiritual and physical implications. Sarah has an interesting comment when Isaac is born. It says, he has brought me laughter, and there's a number of ways in which that's significant, one of which is the name Isaac, because the name Isaac was given, it means he laughs. Isaac means he laughs. And because there's at least two instances of laughter before this chapter, one with Abraham and one with Sarah. You remember where they were?
When the Lord told her she was going to have a child, and she laughed.
Yeah, and she laughed, and you remember God said, oh, so you think that's funny, huh? And what'd Sarah say? Did you hear somebody laugh? And so it's ironic, here she's able to say that out loud and publicly say, God has brought me laughter, because, see, this is again, God's grace to Sarah. We've seen Sarah commit some real blunders. But she loved God. She was holy. She devoted herself to her husband. She loved her husband. And so she's getting the grace finally at last too. And now she's able to laugh out loud without being ashamed of it, instead of chuckling at what God had to say. But remember, even Abraham himself, one of the times when God promised him, he laughed, although it was in a different spirit, because God was pleased with that. Abraham laughed joyfully at the thought that, hey, I'm gonna have a kid when I'm 100 years old. That's great. Because he knew that it was something impossible that only God could do. Mm-hmm. And he didn't hide his laughter, Sarah did, but now they're both able to laugh together. And it's just an example of how when you trust God, when you believe what he says, you can share in the good things of life together and not be ashamed of it. A lot of the things that unbelievers do, they have to be ashamed of. They laugh too, but they have to hide it. They have to do it in secret because it's shameful. Here we have Abraham and Sarah, and they are able to rejoice in the son of Isaac. And just something that we noticed, it says Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he's 8 days old. Now that's a little bit significant, because remember back a couple chapters ago we had the covenant of circumcision, where Abraham and everybody in his household had it done as adults. But here we see that, okay, now this new, to them it was a new covenant. To us it's an old business, but to them it's new. To them, this is how they show that they're belonging to God. I'm accepting this status as holy. Circumcision in the old covenant meant you gave this child to God. This child is now part of this holy covenant. And Isaac is the first example that we have given of being circumcised on the eighth day instead of as instead of as an adult. And so Isaac is given to God as part of this covenant, part of the holy covenant. And yet that has its consequences, because we see now that not long after the child is born, we have problems. Problems between the present and the past. There are problems with Hagar and Sarah. You remember a long time ago, as soon as Hagar had that child, what happened in the relationship between Hagar and Sarah?
Sarah hated her.
Yeah. Hagar started to get a little bit demeaning in her attitude towards Sarah, didn't respect her anymore, and Sarah got very vicious in her attitude towards Hagar. It's a sad thing when you read about it. It really ruined their relationship. Well, the same thing, unfortunately, translates itself to their sons. You had Hagar and Sarah and the struggles in their relationship, and now you have Ishmael and Isaac. It says that Ishmael began to mock Isaac. Ishmael did not like Isaac, and it's very understandable. Mm-hmm. But Isaac is the seed of the promise, the child of the promise, and Abraham is told it's through him that your offspring will be reckoned. So Hagar and Ishmael, they're not getting with the program here. They're making fun of what God is doing. They're rebelling against their own flesh and blood. So naturally, God's going to slap them around a little bit, isn't he? Straighten them out there.
Yep.
Well, what does God do?
Well,
He takes care of them, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's again, we see this over and over again about God, that God is a lover. God is compassionate. And if you give him half a chance, he'll be compassionate to you. If you just don't make it overwhelmingly difficult, he'll be nice to you.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not that God just sits up there and has to, well, I don't know if I really want to help that person out. It's God is up there, would you please let me help you out? See, that we so often reproach God.
You know, don't you understand how hard it is down here?
Don't you understand all this stuff I'm going through? I understand it. Do you understand that I want to help you? If you just stop being so stubborn and prideful and negative about everything. Hagar and Ishmael, they were being stubborn and ornery here, and to the point that Abraham regretfully had to ask them to leave the camp. He regretfully had to say, going to have to leave you guys go out. No, he didn't want to do it, in fact. When Sarah came up and said, you need to get rid of those two. Abraham, hey man, that's my son. This is family right here. And God himself had to say, Abraham, this situation has to be resolved. Let them go. And he doesn't say, let them go because I'll just deal with them. He says, let them go because I'm going to take care of them. I'll take care of your son. And in fact, Ishmael has been nothing but trouble here. But Abraham is told, he said, I'm going to make Ishmael into a great nation too. Why? Because he's your son, Abraham. Mm-hmm. Because he inherits those same promises I gave you, at least in part. He's not the holy line, but he's going to get those. And there again, from a human logic, what are the consequences of the fact that God made Ishmael and Isaac both into great nations? Well, you just read the newspapers and you'll find out what some of the consequences are. God must not have known what he was doing, was he? Well, it's not God's fault that they couldn't get along. God's part was that he loved them both and he blessed them both and made them into a great nation. It's their decision to hate each other and fight each other. The problems of the world don't come from God. Now, you can blame God for the fact that he loves everybody so much. He permits all these people and all their sins and problems to exist and blesses them and feeds them and clothes them every day. But he's not the one that causes the problems. It's something that's important to understand about God is that, see, we're the ones who goof stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
There's a proverb that says, a man's own folly ruins his life, and yet his heart still rages against the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all these problems that you read about, in one sense, they're a consequence of the fact that God is so patient and compassionate that he doesn't wipe people out when they deserve it. But God is just being God. He's just being a blesser. He's just being compassionate. He's compassionate to Ishmael. He gives grace to Hagar and Ishmael when they despair. And it's another thing to notice, when Hagar and Ishmael were being confrontational and negative and mocking towards Abraham and Sarah, what did God have to let happen to them? They had to wander off in the wilderness by themselves and not know where they were going.
Right.
But then what do? When Hagar sits down, despairs, and stops trying to do everything herself, what does God do? Now it's time for me to take care of you. Now I can take care of you and do what I want. Don't worry about it, Hagar. I'm going to make Ishmael into a great nation. So the grace comes when they do what? When they throw themselves on God's grace. Mm-hmm. When they stop being stubborn. When they stop. Look. I had this son by Abraham, and I had it before Sarah's, and I deserve this, and I deserve that, and why isn't God doing this? When we're doing that, God just says, okay, I'm sorry, you're going to have to go wander out in the wilderness for a while. Find yourself a well someplace.
Because he wasn't part of the promise.
That's right. And so, but even Hagar and Ishmael, when they humble themselves, and when they say, we have no place to turn, all of a sudden God pours out the grace. The grace is available whenever we let God give it to us. Mm-hmm. Give him half a chance. Give him a tenth of a chance to show you grace, and he'll give you grace. But it requires our humility, and that's what can be so difficult. Now, we're not going to read the rest of this chapter here. A little incident with Abimelech, this guy that Abraham lied to a couple chapters ago. He comes back, and Abraham, being who he is, Abimelech's all friendship and goodwill. He sees that Abraham's a man of God. Doesn't matter that Abraham lied to him and caused him some trouble. He wants to be friends with Abraham, and they swear an agreement, a pledge of kindness. And there's even this little incident at this place that comes to be called Beersheba, where there's a dispute amongst their servants about who dug this well. And instead of making a big confrontation of it, Abraham says, my servants dug the well and your servants kind of appropriated it for their own use there, so let me do what? I'm going to get tough about this. Abraham gives him 7 lambs, gives him a gift, because that's Abraham's concept of how to solve a problem. It's not dig in your heels and argue about it. It's, hey, I'm going to give you these so you know my intentions are good. I don't mean any trouble by this. But just another example of Abraham's character. So things are going okay. Had a little problem with Ishmael and Hagar, but got Isaac now. Sarah's finally in a good mood. Sarah's able to laugh and not to pretend that she's not laughing. Now it's time for kick back and let the good times roll, right? Well, chapter 22 is pretty notorious in a lot of circles. It's a very shocking thing, this test that God devises for Abraham. And it's something that's attracted the attention not just of believers, but of unbelievers, and not just of theologians, but of philosophers. Someone hit my eraser. Someone's trying to send me a little message here. We'll figure out something, but...
Here's a towel.
Give you a chance to catch some action footage there, tracking down the eraser. You call this an eraser? They don't make erasers the way they used to, do they? I tell you, back in the old days, erasers were really erasers. Anyway, chapter 22 is something that we really want to learn from. It's certainly something that a lot is made of, and it concerns Isaac. Now, it's interesting, if you read the scripture that I jotted down on the list over here, Galatians 4 tells us that Hagar and her son Ishmael, who was born in the natural way, and Isaac, the son who was born according to the promise, they kind of have spiritual parallels. And Galatians, it tells us that these are kind of representative of following God by law versus following God by faith and grace. And the illustrations in Galatians 4 is just an analogy. It's only an analogy. Analogy is not represented every aspect of spirituality. Analogies imply no moral judgment of any sort. Void where prohibited, see store for details. Some restrictions apply. But it's only analogy. Galatians 4 doesn't mean Hagar and Ishmael were snakes. It just means that as a parallel, Isaac coming by the promise and the fact that it's through Isaac that Abraham's true offspring, physical and spiritual, would be reckoned, it's because Isaac was accepted on the basis of faith. Ishmael was born as a result of a natural process that had its natural conclusion. Galatians contrasts them to say that Ishmael's birth represents people who follow God by law. You do the right thing, it has certain consequences that are come naturally, and vice versa. And Hagar and Ishmael, their relationship with God, God loved them. And they, to some degree, trusted God. But they could never really see or accept or appreciate the real promises that God had in mind because they followed by law, figuratively, not judgment on them as people. Isaac came as a result of a promise. And so because Isaac was born by faith, Isaac was able to be the fulfillment of spiritual promises and be fully able to live by faith. Now, with all that on the table, we come in chapter 22. And if you read these first couple verses of chapter 22, if you'd never read this before, it would probably come as a real shock what happens here. First couple verses of chapter 22. Norma, have you got that?
Yes.
Just read verses 1 and 2 right now.
Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about."
You see, that really comes as a shock if you are following along in this and didn't know what was going to happen. All this stuff about Isaac being the child of promise, and through Isaac your descendants are going to be reckoned, and all of a sudden God says, "Hey, Abraham, go kill him. Make a sacrifice out of him." And it is shocking, and it should shock us a little bit, and in a lot of ways. Certainly the action itself and also the implications. There's a lot of things going on there. And it's something that, of course, we know how it turns out, so we don't have to go through the agony of it the way that Abraham and Isaac would have. But it's certainly something that gets your attention. And it's interesting, even when God says this command, he even makes it harder for Abraham, because how does he describe Isaac?
The son whom you love.
Go and sacrifice Isaac. You know, your only son, Isaac, sacrifice him. You know, your son whom you love, sacrifice him. It doesn't even say, you know, that little kid's not going to be worth anything anyway. Why don't you sacrifice him, Abraham? Why don't you let me have him? He emphasizes how difficult it's going to be. He knows that this is going to be gut-wrenching for a father to do. So he emphasizes it. And of course, along with that, it goes the promises. So he says, your son whom you love, and the child of the promises, he says, sacrifice him. And there's an interesting book, actually a very well-known book, philosophical work, well-known to those of you who study philosophy, which is, I believe it's a non-zero number of you. I think that there's a couple of in here you do. A book by Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher of the 19th century, called Fear and Trembling. And it's based on this story. It's based on the incident of this intended sacrifice of Isaac. Kierkegaard had some Christian beliefs, some non-Christian beliefs, but the idea that he had here is that this is kind of the dilemma of faith, the dilemma of belief, being asked to do something that's not only irrational but repugnant. And being a philosopher, Kierkegaard had a real snappy phrase for this. He says that this story is an illustration of the teleological suspension of ethical considerations. I think that clears it all up very nicely, don't you? Well, what he actually means is, the point that he's making is, if you're going to claim to, and this is what the phrase means, if you're going to claim to believe in a God who is truly a God, who is truly transcendent, then you must, to be consistent, always accept that he is right and good, as opposed to judging him by your standards. Basically, what he's saying is that this story, Abraham, illustrates the fact that believing in God trumps everything else. Believing that God was truly God trumps all these other rational things. That to Abraham, and this is what he means by teleological suspension of ethical considerations. And this is what he's saying is that he believed God. I'm certain that Abraham did not believe in child sacrifice. I'm certain that he didn't even believe in child abuse or anything like that. I'm certain that Abraham believed in being a nice guy. He believed in family values and all that kind of stuff. But his belief in God trumped all that. His trust in God trumped everything else.
His
faith in God, the fact that God told him to do this, overrode everything else. That's why he's such a challenging example, because most of us don't do that. We read in the scriptures things that contradict the values of the world, and we trust the world. We read in the scriptures where it says, if someone whacks you on the cheek, turn the other cheek and let them take another sock at you. And we say, well, there's a lot of exceptions to that. You know, we read where it says, don't show favoritism. And we say, well, you know, there's times when favoritism could be beneficial in a numerical way or in terms of growth and that. Because we really don't trust God above all else. We have these human values that are just as important, and in some cases we let the human values trump what God has to say. This is what Kierkegaard meant by that real snappy phrase. He just meant, if you believe in God, then you got to be consistent and let him be God. That's what he was saying, and that's what he was pointing to. Now, he had a lot of other ideas that were pretty screwy, so don't think that he's some great example or anything like that. But like most philosophers, he has a few very good insights, and this is what he used this story as an example of. So, go ahead, Don, did you want to comment or question?
Yeah, I was just saying, Abraham's faith is pretty amazing here when you think about, and he believed, God told him he was going to have a son, he believed what God said. God, and that his son was going to, all these great things were going to happen through his son, and he believed what God was going to, what God said. Then God told him to sacrifice him, and, you know, he still held to his faith in God. Over in Hebrews 11, it talks about that.
Why don't you go ahead and read 17 and 19, because I had that on the schedule here. Why don't you go ahead and read that, okay. Because it explains Abraham's perspective.
By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, and Isaac your descendants should be called. He considered that God was able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. He knew God promised a son. God promised great things would happen through him. God told him to sacrifice him. Well, how are we going to reconcile? Well, I guess God must be able to raise him back from the dead.
That's right. No problem. And you see, it's interesting. Abraham had this thing in his mind, didn't he? Now, was he correct in his guess of what God was going to do?
No,
he wasn't. But he was correct in a more important way, which is what that scripture in Hebrews pointed out. He knew that God has power over life and death. So he knows what God tells him to do with related to life and death. God knows what he's doing. He's got the power to override this. Now, Abraham thought, I'm going to go ahead and sacrifice him, and then God's just going to raise him right from the dead again, which was incorrect. That's not what God was going to do. But in a broader sense, Abraham had the right idea. Now, this is why I have this little diagram over here. We have some scientific types here. Who can guess what this is supposed to represent?
It's an airfoil.
It's an airfoil. Very good. See, I knew we had some of these engineers that can help out. I put this up here because I remember the first time when I was a kid that I had to go on an airplane. Now, I was maybe 10 or 11, which means I was old enough that I'd already had a lot of people pull a lot of stuff on me, and I didn't just take people's word for things anymore. In fact, in our family, we had a couple of uncles who apparently accepted the responsibility for making sure that the next generation did not grow up sane, because they filled us with all kind of weird stuff. So we were supposed to go on an airplane to visit some of our relatives who had moved away, and I got to thinking about it, and I thought, that is not possible. I am not interested in going on that thing. That thing is a lot heavier than air. Now, if you would fill it up with helium, then I could see how it could rise up and fly. But if you fill it up with helium, then we're not going to be able to breathe and we're going to die anyway. Well, fortunately, my dad understood how airplanes work. And he drew me this diagram, and he showed me how it works. The airfoil is designed like this. You look at a wing of an airplane, it'll have roughly this shape. The front end, the leading edge of the wing, will have this heightened, rounded thing, and then it tails back like this. And the reason it does that is because if you get this thing to move, you know, when an airplane starts moving along the takeoff strip, you start moving it forward, and the air currents, of course, are forced to go around the airfoil. These blue lines are supposed to be air. The air below the airfoil goes straight, and it covers just the distance of the airfoil here. The air that goes around the top, it has to go a longer distance because it's forced to go around the shape of the airfoil. And the point is that the air will go around at the same time, but this air has to travel a longer distance because it's a curved distance, which means scientifically that this air will put less pressure on the airfoil than the air underneath. This air is going slower. It's a basic principle of fluid flow. The higher the speed, the less pressure you put on it. You know, something that goes past you real quick is going to put less pressure than something that goes slower. So what's going to happen is this air is going to be pressing down just a little bit, whereas this air is going to be pressing up a lot more. And this creates lift. And so it naturally lifts the aircraft off the ground. And if you go at a high enough speed, then it gives you enough lift to pull it even a heavy aircraft off the ground. Now, the point that I'm going to make here is, see, at this point, my dad explained that very well. My dad understands those kind of things. Now, at this point, I had a choice to make. I could either be a skeptic for skeptic's sake. Okay, you answered that question. Now can you answer some other questions? Or I can say, okay, obviously there is scientific theory behind this. And I could go ahead. Now, because there's a lot else involved in an airplane, if you look at a jet airplane, it's got all kind of lifts and things and other things going on that cover a lot of the fine points. But what my dad said to me is, what's the basic reason why you don't think that plane can fly? It was just a lot heavier than the air. Well, that answers that question, doesn't it? That tells you how it can fly despite the fact that it's heavier than the air. Well, now there, the question came to be, was I just going to be an ornery skeptic for skeptic's sake? You say, okay, well, I got a lot of other questions too. Or say, yeah, you answered the big, that's the big question. That's the big problem that I had. And my dad answered it, and so I got on the plane. Well, see, this is Abraham's big problem is, he's been waiting all these years for the son, and God now tells him to kill the son, who was supposed to be the source of all these great nations and everything like that. Well, what's the big issue? The big issue is if he's dead, then he can't be the father of many nations, can't he? So Abraham answers the big question. Abraham answers it, God has power over life and death, doesn't he? So God's going to take care of it. Now, he didn't understand how God was going to take care of it, but the big question was answered. And see, there again, that's really what faith is about. It's not about getting all your questions answered. It's about getting the big question answered. That's about getting the big issue dealt with. The big issue here is not, well, how are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? Is it moral? Is it legal? Can we do this? The big question is, if he's dead, that he can't be the father of the nations. Abraham said, God's got power over life and death. That's good enough for me. Abraham's little scenario was completely erroneous, but it didn't matter because God knew that Abraham had the big thing on straight. And of course, that's an obvious lesson for us, isn't it? You know, they get the big things on straight instead of fussing about all the little stuff. You know, it's like the guy, the Christian that was walking along in the wilderness one day and he sees this guy hanging off a cliff or standing at the edge of a cliff getting ready to jump. And he says, hey, what are you doing? Life really stinks. I'm going to end it all. Well, let's think about this. Maybe I can help you out here. You know, do you believe in God at all? Oh, yeah, I believe in God. You any particular religion, Buddhist, Muslim, anything? Oh, no, I'm a Christian. He said, well, I'm a Christian too. You know, now, what are you, Baptist, Episcopalian, Catholic? He said, actually, I'm a member of the Churches of Christ. And the guy said, hey, I go to the Church of Christ too. I think I can really help you out here. He says, tell me a little bit about your church. Well, I said, oh, yeah, it's a pretty good church, I guess. The guy starts asking, well, I mean, is it, you know, instrumental church? Or he says, no, it's not an instrumental church. And the guy says, well, you know, you don't belong to some of those kooky churches or anything like that. You know, it's a pretty normal church. You know, we non-instrumental, you know, pretty traditional and all that. And the guy says, see, we got a lot of common. You know, if you don't jump, I can really help you out here. You know, just if you'll just listen. And this jumper, the suicidal guy says, well, maybe you're right. You know, you're helping me. And he says, as a matter of fact, you remind me of this deacon at our church who organizes our praise team every Sunday. And the first guy says, praise team, shoves him off the cliff and says, you heretic. Well, that's kind of illustrative of the opposite of the Abraham principle. Get the big stuff on straight. Get the big things straight so that you don't goof up all the little stuff. Well, we know the story. There is this fearful journey of faith where Abraham takes the son along. And we've been focusing on Abraham, but this little incident was probably no picnic for Isaac either. Yeah. I don't think this was going to be one of his favorite childhood memories. You know, I remember my childhood. There's a lot of weird things that happened that I can't get out of my memory box. I think this would have been Isaac's equivalent of that. And you see, Isaac, I mean, he's old enough to understand what's going on because you see, he talks in the story. He asks his father, hey, you said we were going to go sacrifice something. What are we going to sacrifice? Not too many things here to sacrifice. You, me, we left the camels and horses behind there. What's going on here? And then his dad starts to bind him up and sit him on top of that altar there. And Isaac's, I don't think he was stupid or anything. I think he started to get the idea. Well, Abraham just tells him God's going to provide. Well, you know, see, Isaac is showing some faith too. We always refer to this as a test of Abraham, but Isaac had some options here too. And he didn't use any of them because what did he have? He had faith. He trusted his dad. He trusted God. And so it's a test of Isaac too. And of course, God provides this providential ram and all is well. God had it all figured out all along. And God goes on to say, because you trusted me, I'm going to bless you, and even more so than before. And it's this faith that they had. Obviously, we're very familiar with the story, but it helps to put your finger on exactly what it teaches us about Abraham. You know, I was talking about this guy, Kierkegaard, this philosopher. His philosophy is worth reading, even though he's a little bit, he's very depressing. He had this one book called Fear and Trembling, and he had this other book called Sickness Unto Death. I mean, the guy really could have used a focus group to run these titles by. But he had an insight that's very important, is he said he really viewed all problems of practical daily living as our inability to deal with the inevitability of death. He basically said, it's because we can't deal with death that we have all these problems. Because you basically got two choices. You can either deny death and just pretend you're never going to die, in which case your whole life's going to be a delusion. You're just going to be delusional your whole life. Or you can accept it, in which case it's going to drive you crazy and you're going to spend all your life anxious and neurotic. Well, that's why I tell you he kind of missed some important things there. But you see, he's describing that's your choice if you don't believe in God. If you don't believe in the gospel, that's your choice. If you don't believe in the gospel, that is the only two choices you've got. Deny it and live a life of illusion and lies, or accept it and live a life of neurosis and anxiety. It's only by being like Abraham and realize God is able to raise the dead that we can have a true way out of what otherwise is an insolvable dilemma. And I'm sure you're all going to go ahead and read some Kierkegaard after that. Just to quickly summarize these last few chapters, we have moving ahead, chapter 23 and 24, we see the inevitable passing from one generation to the next. Sarah passes away. She got to enjoy 25, 30 years with her new son and to see him grow, but she passes away. Abraham buries Sarah. Abraham's time is coming to an end. Abraham starts to think ahead. In chapter 24, he tells his servant, he's concerned about Isaac and his future. He doesn't want Isaac to go back home to Babylonia and live there. He wants Isaac to stay in Canaan because that's where he's from. And so he has his servant go back to his family to bring back a suitable wife for Isaac, who is Rebekah. You know, Abraham realized that he is going to die. You know, it's like sometimes people like to pretend that you're not going to die. They say things like, oh, I'm still going to live on in the hearts of my friends. Well, you might remember what Woody Allen said. He said, I don't want to live on in the hearts of my friends. I want to continue to live on in my own apartment. That's what's called the denial option right there. Well, Abraham realized, I lived this life with all these blessings, but that's not what it was. It wasn't for just for me to have a great life. I got to be concerned about the future. Abraham is very careful, very particular about the wife he picks for Isaac. Turns out to be Rebekah. And we'll leave it there. We'll pick up with there next week. Thanks as always for your attention.